Welcome to Next Level Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Tara Perry. For 25 years, I've helped professionals, first responders, celebrities, Olympians, teachers, moms, dads, and people just like you achieve their results better and faster than they thought possible. This is where measurable modern science meets the quantum. We're so glad you're here. Let's dive right in. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Next Level Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Tara Perry, and I am so thrilled at my guest today. It's William Peters. He is a licensed psychotherapist and the founder of the Shared Crossing Project. The mission of Shared Crossing Project is to positively transform people's relationship to the death and dying through education and raising awareness about shared crossings and their healing benefits. As the director of the Shared Crossing Research Initiative, William and his team collect and study extraordinary end-life experiences, shared crossings. William is a global leader in shared death studies and end-life phenomena. He has developed methods to facilitate the shared death experience, known as SDEs, and to assist experiencers in meaningfully integrating their experience. William is a psychotherapist at the Family Therapy Institute of Santa Barbara, where he specializes in end-of-life counseling as a means towards psycho-spiritual evolution. He served as a hospice worker with Zen Hospice in San Francisco. His work is informed by his two NDEs, near-death experiences, and a variety of shared crossings. He has presented at the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine's annual conference. His research has been published in the American Journal of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, Omega Journal of Death Studies, and many others. His book is At Heaven's Door, What Shared Journeys to the Afterlife Teach About Dying, Dying Well, and Living Better. It is published by Simon & Schuster and is also available on audio. And thank goodness it's read by him, because I love hearing from the author directly. Welcome to the show, William Peters.
Thank you so much, Tara. Real pleasure to be here.
Goodness, there's so much to unpack. Would you first tell us, because I didn't know myself until I read your book, what a shared death experience is? I mean, I was really kind of blown away when I found out how really common it is and how much benefit there is to the people who experience this.
Yes. So a shared death experience is almost identical in phenomena to a near-death experience. The difference is this: a shared death experiencer is typically either at the bedside or remotely located at the time of a loved one's death. And what they report is that they feel like they shared in the journey from this human existence into, for lack of a better term, an afterlife, or the continuation of consciousness of their departing loved one. And so why it is similar to the NDE is because the phenomena that we see in the NDE are also observed by the shared death experiencer. So by that, I mean, they'll see, first of all, a major difference we'll start with is, you know, on a near-death experience, it's the near-death experiencer having a brush with death, and they go on this journey largely alone. So they may see their deceased relatives, they may see elevated spirit beings, they'll see the heavenly realms, they might have a life review, they might see a tunnel. Of course, the main feature in the NDE is the light, which occurs in about 75% of the studied cases. The shared death experience will see all of those experiences as well, or I should say it differently, they have the possibility of observing those phenomena. But the main difference is the shared death experiencer, in over half our cases, encounters and communicates with the dying while they are in that afterlife space, or that journey from human existence into the afterlife. I use afterlife because that is the term that our now many hundreds of research participants tell us. I went with my loved one into the afterlife.
And
so there's
and I know
a
lot of people like you in this space, they don't like that term because you feel like it's not a, an appropriate, tell us why you don't like the term so much.
Well, I think the more you work with this, and you're correct, those of us who are studying these end-of-life experiences in particular, what we come to is, well, I'll say it for myself because others see it differently, but the way I see it is this: there's life.
Beautiful.
And then there's human death. But life itself does not stop at human death. Life continues. So there is no afterlife. Life is the substrate of being a conscious entity, being whatever you want to call it. We're just having a human experience. So when this human experience ends, it doesn't mean that all the research that I've done and those of my colleagues suggest that, you know, we go on in some form. You can debate what that form is, but there's a continuation of consciousness beyond human death. So to the term afterlife just is inappropriate.
And that's kind of true, and in all religions kind of teach that, don't they? I mean, isn't that a common thread? And yet it's so crazy that in our society, death is such, I mean, it's one of the most avoided topics. It's the one that's most pushed under the rug.
Hey guys, studies are showing that 68% of people that watch podcasts regularly don't click the subscribe button. Do me a huge favor. If you like this content, click subscribe so other people know where to go for the cool stuff. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I mean, it just kind of almost seems it's an interesting incompatibility that people have these experiences. They're hugely percentage-wise positive experiences where they come back with a whole different set of values, a different sense of purpose, more meaning to their life, more meaning to the relationships that they have in their lives. And yet, you know, in academia, I don't think it's changing, but it has been very pushed under the rug for a long time. And in journals, I mean, you are now published, but that took a long time to get there, didn't it?
Well, yeah, you've asked a number of really great questions there. So let me start with the first point you made, which I think is just spot on, and that is the modern culture's relationship to death is highly problematic in the sense that as moderns, we're probably the first, if you will, iteration of the species that is completely out of touch with death. In other words, pre-modern cultures saw death as a natural part of a full life. In fact, just me saying that sounds so ridiculous. Of course, there's no one who's ever incarnated in a human existence that has not died. And yet, our medical establishment still perceives death as a failure. Mm. And that is a problem, because when you go into traditional medical environment, their goal is to keep you alive. Now, that's great if you've got, you know, you have a temporary injury or, you know, some sort of traumatic event that is temporarily threatening your life. But for the overwhelming number of people who come to end of life, and that's 90% now, 90% of people are going to die in a kind of from either a terminal illness like a cancer or some sort of organ disease. There's just old age where your body just gives out. And that's the most common way that people die. And yet we treat those experiences as if it's a 20-year-old man, unfortunately, in an automobile accident who we need to keep alive. These are radically different situations. And the medical community, quite frankly, has not developed enough of a discernment system that will allow them to distinguish, hey, what is a situation, albeit medically distressed, that requires us to prepare for death rather than to fight against death? And, you know, I, as you mentioned in the introduction to me, I work a lot with people at the end of life with terminal illnesses. And I can't tell you how many people, the vast majority of smart people, are getting chemo for a cancer diagnosis that everybody knows there are very few known survivors, and their quality of life in the last months, if not years, is really depleted. And it's so traumatizing, not just for the patient who's going to die from the cancer, but also for the family members.
Tell us about the recent studies that have been done where they, you know, looked at all the people that had gone through and terrible intervention, extraordinary expense, without having an improvement of quality of life, and probably not an extension of the time of life either, and how most people, when they're informed, would prefer not to go that way.
Yeah, you're correct about that. And I want to be clear that there are a lot of times when medical interventions for cancers and other disease patterns are absolutely indicated, and they are quite successful. But too much of the time, we're sitting at stage four cancer, it's terminal, and we're still doing chemo. Why? Because it's the only thing that the medical community has to offer. But that's a poor excuse when you know the efficacy of those interventions are incredibly low, and they're extremely painful for the patient and for the caregiver loved ones to observe.
So what needs to happen? Does there need to be more of an informed consent? I don't know. What does the data suggest, and what's the answer?
Yeah. I mean, there's a number of interests that kind of come together here to create a problem. One is the patients and perhaps their families, and oftentimes it's the family more than the patient, really want to believe that there is a cure out there somewhere. And they work with the mindset that, well, you know, if we can just make it a little bit longer, then maybe we'll be able to get on a trial and what have you. But that is the lotto on steroids. That just doesn't add up when you look at the statistics. That's just, for some cancers, we haven't had any new efficacy in medications since the 70s. For most organ cancers, that is, for most cancers in the viscera, in the abdomen area, we don't have them. And I mean, I know that because I refer to doctors and they will tell me, the ones I have good relationships with will say, yeah, William, we can't do much here. And the family may be asking for something, and I'll give it to them if they want it. But gosh, maybe you can talk to them and just prepare them. And then I'll say the same thing. So there's a lot of great doctors, a lot of great oncologists out there who want to tell them the truth. But like I said, when you have the patients and their families wanting to keep fighting, that's a big moral value in our culture, to fight, to be alive, especially cancers. Cancer is the only disease that somehow we feel inclined as a culture to fight against. You don't see people fighting against heart attacks, or are fighting against liver disease, or fighting against, you know, kidney failure. You only fight cancer for some reason. Now, that's what I'm not going to unpack today. But that, as a psychotherapist, I'm like, how did this happen?
Interesting.
So long story short, we have the interest of the medical community to keep people alive at all costs. We have patients and their family members who want to prolong life. And we have a culture that is wholly uneducated about what actually happens at death, and is unable, we have not as a culture offered our populace alternative views to death and dying, of which all of us who research end of life realize, if we prepared for end of life, we could really create beautiful transitions.
So what would that preparation look like? What would be the components of that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is what the Share Crossing Project has been focused on. And you read it in our mission statement. And what we realized is that when you accept that you and your loved ones at some point are going to die, and that it's better to prepare in advance for that, what that means is there's a whole like a psycho-emotional steps in here, like in spiritual steps, really being present with your loved ones and talking honestly about the fact that I love you, but I realize at some point either you or me is going to die. So I don't want to live blind about that. I want to express my love to you. If there's any misgivings you have or any regrets, let's talk about them. Stay current and present in the psycho-emotional aspects of your relationship. Don't push off difficult conversations because we all assume we have years to discuss these with our loved ones. Truth of the matter is, we don't. At some point, we're not going to have that.
And that is a huge takeaway from your book, is just the really to feel the love with your loved ones and to experience that. And the death is part of that.
Absolutely. If you can clear a space in your relationship to talk about the fact that you and your loved ones are going to die, and it can be even, you know, lighthearted. Hey, you know, how do you want to die? Or when do you think you're going to die? Or like, how are you feeling about life and death? And really talking about it and letting everybody know your preferences. Like, some people are like, you know, if I get that disease, don't keep me alive. Others are like, no, I want to fight. You know, and this is all in the advanced care literature. If you know, there's a way to do that. But the advanced care literature is not enough. Even if you fill out these documents sufficiently, they don't do the deeper relational, conversational, heart-opening pieces that, you know, certainly the Shared Crossing Project focuses on. We believe that those documents are a start, but they're just the start. They're the context of which you need to really discuss in deep your feelings, your desires, your preferences for a variety of ways in which, you know, you can die. I mean, I was working with a couple the other day, and they came in and they were kind of shocked because I'd actually known them before, but they had an experience over the holidays where she almost died. This, they're, you know, in their middle ages, and they were just snorkeling and she choked and started going down, and he was looking at, you know, this is kind of a joke. He was engaged looking at a, you know, a beautiful, you know, Nimoy fish, you know, one of these beautiful, you know, whatever, like, I don't know what kind of fish it is, but he was like, and then all of a sudden he turns around and he's like, and he sees his wife floating down. He has to save her. And like, this becomes a whole thing. It's like, you know, we weren't ready for that. But we just realized you can die anytime. And, you know, when you talk to your friends, and just a basic conversation, hey, do you think you could die at any moment? No one's going to say, oh yeah, I think I'm going to die in the next week or two, or I'm going to die in the next month or next year. Nobody is prepared for the reality that we can die at any time. And so we as a culture are constantly, utterly shocked and betrayed.
That's true.
When we get a diagnosis or something happens to us, like, how could this happen? Well, the real question is, how could we not think this could happen when everybody who's ever walked this earth eventually dies? So the preparation is just that. Stepping into the reality that everyone we love is going to die. And we are included in that subset.
So for our listeners who aren't totally familiar with near-death experiences, I have been fascinated with them for a long time. Share with us your first NDE so that they have an understanding of what the elements are that are common to NDEs and how it shifts people's lives.
Yes, absolutely. And before I do that, I want to say what I'm going to share with you is why is part of the conversation, because everything that an end of life or near-death experiencer, or in my case, the whole shared death studies field, we all are in awe of what we have learned from the many thousands, tens of thousands of people that we have interviewed. This is the closest data you can get to what happens during a death process, a transition, because that's really what it is, a transition from, you know, whatever you want to call that aspect of ourselves that survives human death. First of all of us who study it kind of are on the same page about that we do survive human death and we go on in another form, call it soul, spirit, consciousness, whatever. It is difficult to find negative reports. That's not to say that near-death research doesn't have, you know, 5 to 7 to 8% of what they call, you know, stressful or negative near-death experiences. When we work with those as psychotherapists, they're usually transformed into positives, even though initially, through the misunderstanding of what was happening to them, they are perceived to be negative. So coming back, Tara, to your question. So my first near-death experience, I was 17 years old, was skiing in Lake Tahoe, and I suffered a high-speed skiing accident, and I crushed my back. And in that moment of impact, everything went dark. It was like the electricity in my body. It's like, just remember this, zzz, boom. And then everything went dark. That was the first time I realized, oh my gosh, there's a hum in my body. There's an electrical current in my body, and it just kind of went out. It was kind of like, you know, I don't know if you remember the old MASH TV series.
I do.
That's going back some time. But you know what? And when you get, when those medical facilities, if you will, those kind of remote or temporary hospitals near enemy lines, in this case, it was in Korea, but I'm sure they're the same all over the world. When they get bombed, their generators that produce the electricity get shut down temporarily. And all the lights go out. Everything goes dark. Everyone gets panicked. And then they come back on again. And they kind of come back on slowly, like, you know. So that's what happened to me. And I had this fall. Everything went dark. And then gradually, and then while it was dark, I still had an observing consciousness going like, wow, this is dark. There's nothing here. But I still had an observing aspect of myself. So that witness was there. And then the lights came back on. But when they did, I was looking down at my body on the ski slope. And I was then moving away from that body, increasing with increasing speed. Soon I saw the chairlift, and I saw, you know, the ski area, which today is named Palisades. Then I saw beautiful Lake Tahoe. Keep in mind, I'm not in any pain. I am completely enamored, blissed out by this experience. Then I see the Colorado Rockies, San Francisco Bay Area, continental North America. Wow, look at, you know, Europe and South America. And now I'm seeing this beautiful globe like it's a satellite picture. And I'm just moving away very quickly. At the same time, my life is being reviewed in front of me. And for a 17-year-old young man, I was really getting some lessons on karma. You know, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Boy, everything kind of learned, everything matters. God, I didn't know that that conversation had impacted him that much. And eventually I see this light in the distance. It starts as a pinprick. It gets my attention. I'm in a rib tunnel. I'm looking through this tunnel at this beautiful, hyper-alive universe with, you know, stars and planets and other things just sailing by. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. But then the light gets bigger and bigger, and I realize, oh, I'm dying. And when that happened, I realized, oh, I don't want to die. And, you know, I grew up Catholic, so when I get close to that light, I'm like, God, you can't let me die. I didn't complete what I came into that life to do. Now, I'm saying these words. I have no idea why I'm using that language. But I do know that I had been in that space after a human life hundreds of times. So this was not a new place for me. And so I pled to come back. I went in fully into the light, by the way. I was fully ensconced in the light. It felt like there aren't words for that feeling. It was velvety, warm, and comfortable, and loving, and belonging, and wow. At that point, I was like, you know what? Forget what I said. I'll just hang out here. But then I feel this pushback from the light. And as I'm moving out of the light, I'm like, oh, well, what's happening? And I get this, make something of your life. And it wasn't a voice. It was just a communication. I'm not sure how I got it, but it was strong. And then I made my way back to my body on the ski slope. And when I came back into that body, I was in a lot of pain because I had fractured my back. And I would live the next 30, you know, plus years with really debilitating back pain, difficulty walking, difficulty sitting, you know, just really painful. I pushed through. I don't think, you know, I just kept doing the things I wanted to do and tolerated the pain, but it was not a pleasant experience. And there was more than, you know, as many as half the days when I would have traded my life very willingly for what I experienced in that near-death experience, and I wished I'd never pled to come back. So that was the level of pain I was dealing with episodically. So, but that's a near-death experience.
And what are commonalities for near-death experiences? What are the, I know the life review, seeing that light, yeah. What percentage of near-death experiences have those features? I know there's the time and space gets all weird, and even people that don't believe in God or a connected consciousness come back not only believing in it but knowing it in their gut. Is that correct?
You're 100% correct. Yeah. So, you know, the most common element in the near-death experience is the light. And when I say element, that's physical element, because they see this brilliant light and people project on it divinity, sacredness, God, what have you.
And a lot of people, when they get to that point, they don't want to come back because it is the most delicious thing they've ever experienced.
Oh my, yeah, you are correct. Well, I had that experience myself. I mean, when I finally got in there, I was like, this is like, I don't want to go back. And you know, there's a lot of people I work with have through the years as they integrate their near-death experience. One of the things, you know, and oftentimes their bodies are ravaged a bit, you know, like if you have a car crash, I mean, you may have all sorts of chronic pain and all sorts of injuries, physical and what have you. Not to mention the trauma, the psycho-emotional trauma from that type of impact that causes the near-death experience. So a lot of these people are seriously questioning, why did they have to come back?
And I also don't want to suggest that anybody do this prematurely. Do you have any comments on that? Because I know some people, like you said, some percentage of these are not good, and they're usually wake-up calls to live their life more fully, to take responsibility, to experience the growth that they came here to experience. So can you speak to that briefly?
Yeah, and I should be really clear. The research says that, you know, the vast majority of people are okay with being back. In other words, they're not wanting to be somewhere else. There is a percentage that is frustrated with being here. Almost everybody reports that and these are the after effects that are so profound here. And that is they believe that they will survive death, that death is an illusion, that they will see their loved ones again. Their fear of death diminishes dramatically, if not completely. And that's the number one statistic, actually, that near-death experiencers, fear of death just drops completely. They don't lose their fear of the dying process, but the death itself, yeah. Obviously, belief in an afterlife, very strong. And as you said, you know, sagely here, that they often have a personally transformative experience that when they return with a renewed sense of purpose and meaning for life generally, like the purpose of human existence, but for themselves personally as well.
Because it is like, and we agreed to be here to take on these challenges. And like you felt when you were heading to that light originally, you know, your thought was, oh my goodness, I've been here hundreds of times and I didn't complete what I went to do. Is that?
Yeah. But my experience is very rare. In fact, I remember talking to Bruce Grayson, the leading near-death experience researcher. I would say he's one of the leading. I think most consider him to be the most prolific on the near-death experience in terms of research. And I talked to Bruce about this one time. I said, how many people get there and have that instant like, oh, I don't want to die, I don't want to die? And he kind of rolled his eyes and says, not very many. You know. So my experience is not indicative of most near-death experiencers. But other experiences, I think the most important one is that they experience the most sublime feelings of love and belonging. It is often said that the near-death experiences, as with the share-death experience, reveals to us our true home, from where we came and to where we will return upon the completion of this human existence. And that kind of cosmological knowledge is pretty powerful and undeniable when you see it in the research over and over and over again. That space where I visited was our true home, not just mine, but for humanity.
And I just wanted to speak to this one subject, because suicide is rather high. Why is it important not to go before your time?
Well, you know, suicide is a really, is a very difficult topic in this day and age, because it is growing to become, you know, I dare say it is exercised as a way to escape the human existence. And I want to be really careful about this, because as a psychotherapist, I'd work with historically a lot of people who have attempted suicide. And most of them have said they regret that. So it's important to know to people who are contemplating suicide that you're most likely in a difficult patch in your life and you should get help. And there's help there. And we know that suicidal ideation is common, particularly in the modern era. But there's help. So there's that. When you look at suicide from the point of view of those of us who look at what we learned from near-death and shared-death studies, we need to be careful here too as well, because I think that realm is so loving and so accepting. So if somebody's feels guilty for committing suicide, I think it's really important. This is particularly helpful for people whose loved ones have committed suicide. It's important to see that they were struggling, they were suffering, but they're likely not going to be punished in the afterlife.
Yeah.
There's a much greater understanding for the trials and tribulations, difficulties of a human incarnation. As you can tell by the way I'm talking about this, I really don't think suicide is a good option. When you're a human being, you have an opportunity to live this life and get help. There's a lot of us out there who've dedicated our lives to helping people who are struggling with the human existence, and we're getting better and better. And we're not shying away from how painful this existence can be. What we're doing is working with people to find meaning in the midst of an often painful life.
Well, and I think when people have had this transition, as you have, and you've experienced that immense love, when you're working with people and sharing that experience with others, it helps create that love here in this plane. I mean, that's kind of the reason for it all, isn't it?
Well, I would say so. I mean, I think, once again, my studies of the shared death experience, which is what I'm, most expert in, is that when you're a loved one and you experience the transition of a transitioning loved one, we're using loved one a lot, but we're all loved ones. So when you're watching someone, observing someone transition, and you feel like you accompanied them in some portion of this, and you see where they're headed, and you see how happy they are, and how they're out of pain. Mm-hmm. This is what we hear all the time. It's like, I saw my mother, and she was happy after years of dementia, after years of steady decline with, a cancer or some organ failure, or just, in and out of the hospital with old age. She's finally free of that body. She's happy. But there's also a kind of an understanding that the human life has taught us something.
Right.
And it's not to be taken lightly. We are here for a purpose that I think, I can say it is difficult for a lot of us to know why we're here definitively. We may have an intuition, an inkling. It is rare for someone to know, I know why I'm here, I'm here to do this, and I'm 100% committed to it. That is kind of a rare insight. Most people are like, well, I'm here, I know I have these key relationships, I have work that's meaningful, or if it's not meaningful, I'm doing it so I can provide for my loved ones or some other greater meaning. But by and large, when you have a shared death experience or a near-death experience, you come back with an understanding that this life does, in fact, have meaning and purpose. And one of our first exercises or steps is figuring that out. What are you here for? Mm. And if you can answer that affirmatively with something that makes your life worth living, then that's a time to stop. Because I will say again, I am a psychotherapist in a very well-to-do town, and I have a lot of people in my practice that have achieved the American dream. And I can tell you, that is a really difficult situation when they have achieved the American dream and they say to me, I'm ashamed to say I'm not happy. I think even though I'm successful, I don't have any financial needs. I seem to have a wife that loves me or a husband who loves me. I have kids that are good kids. There's something missing. Mm-hmm. And most are ashamed to say that. But I can tell you that is the step of freedom right there. And that's where you find your passion. And fortunately, there's a lot of people that, you know, will go through that, that process and really find some higher calling that they'll dedicate their life to. And it's usually something for the betterment of humanity. It's usually some, you know, something to contribute to the common good.
And is that the paradigm shift from being a physicalist to being a spiritualist?
Well, that's a good question. That, you know, so physicalism is a whole type of science, just to be clear. And it's scientific materialism, and it really views the world quite concretely. And where it comes into contact or relevance with consciousness is that physicalists and scientific materialists are kind of very similar, see consciousness as a product of the physical brain. And the term you used is spiritualist or spiritual people, because spiritualist or spiritualism is a whole, you know, religion in of itself, spiritual tradition in and of itself. But those who identify more with spiritual or other forms of advanced physics, for that matter, or people that are more, you know, kind of into the consciousness studies as it relates to physics. And these are more advanced levels of, you know, fourth, fifth, and beyond dimensions, new physics, what have you.
Quantum physics.
Quantum physics is, is another branch of this as well. But even beyond quantum physics now, what we're seeing is that the belief, or, well, a belief would be, they would not say, use that as belief. They would say that the evidence points more towards consciousness as being the foundation of everything else, and we living, the human experience happening within it, that being the creation of the human brain or the existence of the human brain, also within a larger consciousness, and that we are many consciousnesses within that, but these, all these consciousness, all these forms of consciousness or consciousnesses that we want to identify as a self-conscious consciousness, we survive human death. And that goes against physicalism, which says consciousness dies.
Well, there's some really interesting cases, and I would love for you to enlighten us of which ones you find the most striking. But there are so many veridical experiences. For example, if somebody blind has a near-death experience and they describe with great detail that what they see, you know, happening in other portions of the hospital or other places on the planet, and they turn out to be true. Or deaf people who can hear. There's just a whole lot of these cases that are veridical in nature. Which veridical shared death experiences do you find the most striking, and would you share those with us?
Yeah, we have a whole body of these veridical shared death experiences, you know, and I'm just going to use one that's really clear to describe. So what's interesting is, 2/3 of all shared death experiences happen remotely. That means they're not at the bedside. They may be down the hall if the person dies at home in another room. They may be in the family room or the kitchen when someone dies. But oftentimes they're across town or across the world. But what happens is at the moment of death or soon thereafter, the experiencer will say something happens to them where they just, they go into a different state of consciousness and they find themselves, for example, in conversation or in an encounter in a different dimension with their dying loved one. And the dying loved one will often look at them and say, I'm okay. It's all right. I love you. Thank you for loving me. It's my time. Or they may find themselves there and the loved one, the transitioning loved one is disoriented. And the caregiver loved one shows up and says, oh, hey, what's going on? And it says, and then they realize, oh, hey, you need some help. And so, well, yeah. And then they make their way on this journey. And then what happens when they come back from these experiences? Now, these are the remote SDEs. They're not at the bedside. they may not even know that this person is dying, or certainly not has died. But then what happens is the experience is so profound. When they come to, they wake up and they go, my cousin Joe, or, you know, my mother, or my grandmother, my relative, something happened. And I think something significant happened. They're not going to say right away, I think they died. But they know something. So they call up the family member or whoever else, say, hey, just checking in. They don't call, hey, I had this dream. You know, they don't say that. They say, hey, I'm just checking in. And they say, well, that's so interesting because so-and-so just died, or they died last night. And that's a veridical experience because they have an experience that rises above the normal dream life. So I want to be really careful that people say, oh, they're just dreams. No, they're not. These rise above typical dream life to get the attention of the experiencer to say, this requires a response on my part to double check on a loved one, to make sure a loved one's okay. And when they call, they will report, well, I had a communication with them. They came to me, or something was orchestrated so that I could be with them, so that I knew that they would die, so we could say thank you, I love you, goodbye, and that I could know that that loved one is alive and well in an afterlife. So those are veridical experiences that are quite compelling.
And your book, Heaven's Door, is loaded with these stories, and they're so moving. Yeah. I mean, I found myself in tears and shivers going up and down my spine numerous times. It's really delicious to hear these very, very close to home stories that people are sharing. And the overwhelming outcome is that people involved with these feel so much better about what their loved one has gone through and ultimately what they will go through.
Yeah, you're right. The take home for the shared death experience is, and we hear this all the time in our research interviews, you know, we still do them. So I'll tell, you know, put this out to your audience. If you've had a shared death experience, go to our website, sharedcrossing.com, go to the contact page. There's a place where you can submit your experience and then someone on our team will contact you. And what they say invariably is, I know my departed loved one is alive and well. I know that I'll see them again. I am not afraid of death myself. I know when my time comes, I want to be prepared. And I know that I'm okay. I know that I will be okay when my time comes to transition.
And
as you said, they come back with a renewed purpose and meaning after that experience. Like, I got to do something with my life because it's precious.
And because this is your life's calling and you've chosen this environment, you describe yourself as an adept. I was really impressed when I read the number of shared death experiences that you've actually experienced. What is that number these days? And what have those experiences been like for you?
Yeah. Then, so, you know, one thing we're learning in the research is once 41% of the people who have shared death experiences have more than one. So it suggests that we don't know how many people have shared death experiences, but if it's, I think it's, I would say conjecture, it's higher than the near death experience because we have more opportunities to be by people when they're dying. So that we know that between 5 and 8% of at least the North American audience has reported near death experiences. I feel comfortable saying we're at least that amount, and we, for shared death experiences, and could be as much as double. You know, I don't think they're as ubiquitous as, you know, everyone can have them at this point. I do think as a culture, we can develop the capacity to have them. I know that because I train people. We have programs to train people. And when we train people, we find that upwards of, you know, 50%, 30 to 50% will have a shared death experience when they're around a death. So we feel like we have some training interventions that can facilitate these.
So what would be commonalities among people who are, I don't know, open or receptive to these? I believe you said 85% are women.
Well, that's a real great point. Now, this is a stunning research finding, is that about 84% of our respondents in our research, and like I said, we have, you know, at least, you know, 300, 400, 500. I mean, I haven't really gone over the research recently, but a lot, like many hundreds, and 85% are women. Why is that? That's a common question we get from our, you know, the reviewers of our articles and research. Why women? You know, do you have any idea? And you know, and my sense
is
that
we have a thicker corpus callosum.
that could well be. It could be physical
connection.
But I actually think it's more. I think it's more that, first of all, women are more apt to be caregivers. They're more willing to take on that role and care for people at death. Mm-hmm. So they get closer to the dying. I think women are more willing to talk about their experiences, their feelings. They're more communicative than men in the modern era. I would be fine. I don't have any reservation about saying that women are perhaps more intuitive and more connected. I mean, women bring human beings into the world. They probably have a deeper connection. And so I'm fine with all that. But and at the same time, I'm willing to be, you know, wrong about all that. So, but for me, and I also know there's a lot of men like me who are adepts. And there's a lot of women too. But for me, I think my two near-death experiences really showed me the landscape that lies between a human existence and the next dimensions, the afterlife, if you will. And when I started working with people dying, particularly in hospice, I just found myself able to attune to where my patients were, and at a psychic level, maybe at a spiritual level. And when they started moving out of their bodies, I noticed that and I hitched a ride. And I was very open to it because there's a lot of visceral, sensorial cues that are common to the initial stages of a shared death experience. The one that is perhaps the most common is the change in the time-space continuum. The three-dimensional rooms or spaces we live in get warped. The light changes. There's a frequency that changes that I hear in my ears. So all of a sudden, kind of things click a little bit in a little direction. I don't know what causes that, but when I hear that, when I sense that, I know it's time to put my seatbelt on and say yes.
Wow.
And lean in. And then that often as I lean in and close my eyes and I just kind of say a little mantra, you know, I'm yours. Take me if I can be of assistance. And I just go right in. And then the next day, I don't know where I'm actually going to, you know, kind of where my inner eye vision is going to open up. Oftentimes it's I see the dying I'm with. Sometimes I just start seeing visions of a past life, of not past lives, of the life just lived. You know, when my father died, I saw my grandmother there. I saw my aunt. I saw my grandfather. And I should also mention a spectacular feature in the shared death experience, and that is the conductor. And that is that, you know, in about 15 to 30% of our cases, we see this being appear that the experiencer reports. It can be seen or felt, in other words, visible or invisible, but they feel there's a force that's guiding the transition. And sometimes this force is extremely purposeful, like you stay away or I've got this. And they're working with timing and frequency and energy. But that conductor can appear as a big light being, as an angel, as sometimes it's just a normal, you know, person that just looks kind and helpful. But that being has the job of transitioning spirits out of human bodies into the afterlife.
And you have seen those when you've been part of this. And how many estimated SDEs have you seen and participated in?
I mean, probably a couple dozen.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And isn't the experience like more real than real?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I find a great deal of beauty and pleasure, you know, good stimulation here in the human realm when you're in, you know, benevolent environments and lovely relationships of love and what have you, and belonging. You know, that's the best the human experience can be.
Right.
Love and belonging, where everybody knows and loves you and time stops, you know, and that you can have that in nature, you can have that in relationship, you know, what have you. But in the shared death experience, you know, when I am in these dimensions, and I'm no different than anybody else, it's like, you know where the term "oh" comes from. It's like, oh, wow, this is it. There's nothing more. There's no words for this space. It's not just like feelings of love. Yes, feelings of love, but it's feelings of gratitude, of compassion, of generosity, of nothing else matters. Like, just beingness is divine.
Would you say that is the big takeaway from all of this, is to bring that into this experience so that this experience can be more like that experience?
Well, I would say that that's one of the integrative goals when I work with people and I work with myself, is like, how do you bring that truth about the ultimate reality? Now, that's a strong term. For those of us who have these experiences, we see that experience as the ultimate reality, or a more ultimate reality. There may be another reality beyond that. You know, the veil may, you know, rip again and like, oh my gosh, there's another deeper, more real reality, you know. But yes, how to bring those truths into the human existence, that's work. And I will say, when I, you know, myself included, experiencers have to work hard at that, because it can be downright despairing here at times, because what we know and what we've experienced in terms of the peace, the joy, the ease, the belonging, the good feelings, the sublime, and then coming back here and trying to bring that in here, you know, I think most of us do the best we can at doing it, but boy, there are days and interactions where it's like, really? This is hard. And I'm not an angel. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I can be a jerk too on a bad day. But
you know it's
going
to show up in your life review, so you unjerkify yourself, right?
I know. And I mean, and you know, we have our karma. I mean, you know, we have our temperament. We have our personality. We have our traumas. You know, I don't hold anybody who's an experiencer, anyone, to be a loving, kind human being all the time. I do hope people, with reflection, that's the gift of being a human being, is the ability to think and contemplate and review one's life and make decisions. We have space between stimulus and reaction. We have choices that a lot of beings do not have in the human realm. Most are instinctual. We can choose to be reflective and contemplative and make loving, kind choices. But the circumstances don't always dictate that or allow for that. I mean, if we look at our world right now, I mean, wow. I mean, we've got the Gaza Strip. We've got the Ukraine war. We've got a lot of people suffering on this planet. I mean, I spent a good part of my life living and working in Central and South America with impoverished communities.
Actually, you have a story in your book that I'd love for you to share with our listeners, because it was really a pivotal point for you in really getting in touch with compassion with the Muslim women outside the bus when you were in pain and they were begging.
Oh my gosh, yes. Thank you for reminding you of that. You know, now once people say, you know, it was in your book, I always get a little scared. I wrote that book like 3 or 4 years ago. Am I going to remember that? I think I'm not alone. I talked
no,
to
I'm sure. I'm sure. Well, and there's a lot in your book, so that's understandable.
So glad that. So the story in what is Bosnia, actually, modern day Bosnia. I mean, I was now this is only about 3 or 4 years after my NDE, and I'm already in a process. I mean, I've lost my ability, my pain-free body. I've lost my physicalness. I can't be, I'm no longer an athlete. I've got a spinal injury. I'm careful, living in chronic pain. And I do an overnight bus ride from Athens. We're en route to Dubrovnik, Yugoslavia. and at that time, Yugoslavia. And we wake up in the morning and we're in Bosnia. We are in a Muslim part of the world. And I wake up after having been in Athens the day before, and all I'm seeing is women with burqas on, and all you can see is their dark eyes and their hands extended out with sincerity begging. And, you know, I'm like, oh my God, now I'm just getting up. I just wake up barely. And I'm looking in that kind of, you know, state when you wake up, when you're just like open and raw. And I'm like, and these women, the desire, their sincerity, the vulnerability of their need, of their desperation went right into my heart. And I just started crying. I started weeping. I could feel their pain, their suffering, their desperation. And in that moment, I said to myself, I need to be with people like this. And I didn't know why. I would learn many years later, and I do say many years later, that the reason I had that response is I was suffering inside myself. And I did not have the vulnerability to touch the level of pain that they were exhibiting for me. In, you know, it wasn't for me. They were just living it because they were hungry and they had kids on their back that were starving. And so I did make a commitment to go be with those people. And that's how I got to Central and South America in the mid-80s, late 80s too. I was there for 4 years. And had, I was living in two civil wars in Guatemala and Peru. And the irony to that, I don't think there's any irony at all. But it was there that I got exposed to the shamanistic cultures. And the share-death experience in a shamanistic culture is, well, yeah, of course, where do you think you go after you die? And why wouldn't the shamans and others be able to accompany our loved ones to another dimension? We go on journeys all the time. But when they were sharing these stories, some of my colleagues working in these, you know, in these projects were like, God, the, you know, these beliefs are kind of out there. I mean, you know, whatever. They take this medicine, they go on these journeys. It's kind of like la-la land. And I was like, because of my experiences, not because of the way I was raised, but like, this makes sense to mm-hmm. me. But I didn't know why it made sense to me, but I'd been on the most profound journey in my life and their journeys were identical to mine. You know, well, I shouldn't say identical. I think we journeyed to different places, but the death journey was, you know, so.
So you've been, you've been on the compassionate road to helping people through difficult times for a long time.
Well, I think so, but I would also say that, a good part of that in my early days was a combination of I think I have a natural adventurer spirit in me. I really love culture and different people. And I love I love nature. I love different lands. I love different peoples. So, you know, going abroad as I did, while it was a big risk in terms of the political environments I saw myself in, I really am inherently curious and open. And then the shared death and the near-death experiences I had really opened up my mind to so much as possible here. And put differently, the Western definition for meaning and purpose in life does not compute.
Right.
Does not compute.
Yeah.
The materialized American dream is not spiritual salvation. It is not taking you to the other side.
Absolutely.
So
as John Wooden said, no day is complete until you can do something for somebody they couldn't possibly repay. It's in the giving that we experience joy.
Well, boy, isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? And I do. It's the most simple kind of axiom, and it's said in all the great wisdom traditions. It is in giving that we receive.
And I think it's so amazing that we have all the technology to bounce a satellite image or thing off of a communication off of a satellite and have it land to the person next to us. But we are not very good at turning to the person next to us and actually fully being there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So
I am so grateful that you've been on our show today, William. His book is At Heaven's Door, What Shared Journeys to the Afterlife Teach About Dying Well and Living Better. If people want to reach you, if people want to know more, I know, of course, they can go on any of the platforms and purchase your book or get the Audible version. How else can people reach out to you?
Yeah, info@sharedcrossing.com. info@sharedcrossing.com.
Thanks.
And like I said, if you've had an experience, a shared death experience, and you're just wondering about it, you know, send us, write into our contact area an inquiry and we will get back to you. We do have, you know, a lovely team of research interns who are just, you know, they're volunteers, but they help us immensely and they are extremely smart and now well-trained because they've been on so many interviews with us and done the trainings and what have you.
Fantastic. So. Well, thank you for being here on Next Level Healing. Folks, if you loved it, click the subscribe button so you don't miss any future episodes, and we will see you on the next episode of Next Level Healing. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Next Level Healing. Please like, subscribe, and let us know how this helped you. How can it be even more life-changing? We love hearing from you. And if you're eager to upgrade your life, click the button here or go to consulttara.com and get your free customized GPS map. Get the coordinates for where you are now and where you want to go. Clients consistently report it's faster and easier than they thought possible. Remember, you were meant for more, and it is available to you. See you right here next week for our next episode.